Welcome to Discover
Film. Meet tomorrow's filmmakers today.
This is the Discover Film Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Howard. And today I get to interview Che Baker. Che made this fantastic sci-fi feature film called Blue World Order. He submitted it to Film Invasion LA in 2017. And it's such an impressive film, we were really excited to be able to premiere it in North America. Blue World Order is available on iTunes right now, so I highly recommend you go watch it. Che makes it out to the States now and then. I got to meet up with him at AFM last year, and this year he went to Sundance and was stopping in Los Angeles on his way back to Australia, so he stopped in to do a Discover Film interview.
I guess I've always tried to be a storyteller, mm-hmm. And you know, that came from, I think I put in my book, making up elaborate stories every time my mother had asked why I hadn't cleaned my room every week. So, I grew up out in the country in the mountains and not a lot around, so imagination was a big thing. You know, my brother and I used to, we had to entertain each other, so movies were a big part of our, like, I think I got $5 pocket money a week, and so every Friday, go to the video store and I'd spend my $5 and that would be my entertainment. We'd be very excited to get videos every week. So at the end of high school, I was, you know, I had no idea what I wanted to do. Like I was interested in a whole range of things, everything from sports science to astrophysics to, medicine to art to English. And, my martial arts instructor, I was chatting with him one time and he said, what would you do if you didn't have to work for money? Yeah, and I was like, oh, I'd make movies. And he goes, well, do that, because if you love something, you'll be good at it, and if you're good enough at anything, you'll make a living out of it. And so I kind of took that to heart and, you know, went to university for filmmaking and you know, went from there. And always,
so movies were your passion?
Yeah, movies were a passion, but they're also, you know, there's things I'd like to say in the world, I guess. And I find that you can say things, you can connect with people a lot better through books and movies and actually influence people's minds. So, you know, I want to affect how people treat each other. So rather than just standing up and preaching down people's throats, you wrap it up in a sugary pill like an action film, and you know, people accept that, and then they've empathized with the character and they've gone through it, and you can actually change people's opinions and points of view, you know, a lot more than you can having a Facebook argument with them. So, so, you know, that I just thought it was the best medium to affect the most people the most effectively.
Right. So it was born of that, and also being a fan of film.
Yeah.
Using your money to see films. But so had you been writing stories and things through high school, or?
Yeah. Look, I always wrote. I always wrote stories, and you know, I read a lot as a teenager, and my brother and I used to borrow my mother worked at the high school, and we would sometimes get access to the video camera, the school video camera, and we would make either ninja movies, where my brother would beat me up quite a lot, and you know, we'd rehearse, and then when he hit play, he always made a lot more contact, and he'd be a lot harder, and I'd be crying on the ground. He goes, "Oh, but you did it so well! You look so good!" So he was well into the art of manipulating me for performance early. And then, or we would make these little movies with Star Wars figures, which were pretty funny. So, yeah, I guess you grow up learning to read the cinematic language, and then, you know, it's a natural progression to want to learn how to write cinema language. So I found that, storytelling was something that was really cool, and I just literally always wanted to do that. So that led me to a whole career of in particularly in Australia, where there isn't an industry that you can just sort of jump into like Hollywood. You really have to forge your own path. So you always end up doing the job that facilitates the one you really want to do. So if you want to be an actor, you end up kind of directing and making your own stuff. You want to direct, you end up producing. You want to produce, you end up being a digital asset manager for the technology company that builds the servers or something. So I ended up making a living doing corporate videos and working in the technology space and teaching at university and stuff and filmmaking. But it was all kind of self-education, to the point where when I finally decided that, yep, okay, I'm ready to go out and ask for millions of dollars of people, I felt confident enough I could deliver.
So you went from high school to university and majored in film?
So I did TV production at this place called Wagga Wagga in back of Whoop in Australia. And I did an exchange program to North Carolina in Wilmington as part of the university for a year and a bit. And over there, I, worked on film. Wilmington had some Screen Gem studios there. So I worked on Dawson's Creek for a season there, which was fantastic. And I also shot a short film on film, which was a really good experience. And worked on a couple of films in various capacities while I was in Wilmington, and that was a huge education. And I met a group of people who were, originally they were sort of a stunt group, but they went out every weekend and they shot something every weekend. And just amazing, group of guys and girls who, they were just making stuff, so they were getting good at it. And they now have some fantastic, hilarious animations that are doing really well. If you look up Duralius and Associates, it's a really good, funny sort of animation episodes. But university over there, came back and then worked around it. As soon as I got into Sydney, I worked for Apple and sort of learnt the editing stuff, and then I became a Apple master mentor trainer. So I got right into teaching people how to edit and how to set up post-production workflows and things. And that was a really good tangible skill to get my foot in the door. I think a lot of filmmakers kind of, everyone comes out and says, hey, I want to be a director. And that's all very nice, but no one hands you a, well, I mean, over here, maybe, but...
No one hands.
Yeah, very rare that someone says, oh, sure, we'll let you direct this massive movie. So you have to have a tangible skill to get your foot in the door. And mine, I guess, was editing and then shooting. But particularly on the editing post side, I got fairly proficient with that and found my niche. Going from being a technophobe, where I hated it, and then seeing that it was all heading, into the computer world. And I remember having the thought, I either need to learn this stuff inside out or get out of filmmaking, because this is where it's going. And that was a real profound moment in my life. And I decided, okay, because at that stage I didn't own a computer at university. I'd hated plugging cables in. I was very much a technophobe. But a couple of my friends who were younger than me, they were getting into this computer desktop editing thing. And I thought I was behind the eight ball, but they sort of taught me that. And then I came to learn that I was actually still ahead of the curve. And, now that friend just won an Academy Award for Mad Max Fury Road, the VFX and things. So, they were way ahead of the curve. I was very fortunate to...
Yeah, I mean, you say that in Australia there's almost there's not a lot of infrastructure. But there is there is TV, and, right?
Yeah, look,
because we always hear about your TV programs.
It's different. I guess there is, there's a couple of staple soaps that have been going, but the film industry, everything is. Traditionally everything's sort of government funded, or nothing happens without the screen agency deeming it worthy and going through that process and stuff. So that's a real gatekeeper to what actually ever gets made, depending on, you know, if they've come in and if they've invested in this project and they've developed it and everything, then it'll get made. But trying to do it independently is just, has been traditionally very, very hard if you're not in, you know, in the
club. And those controls involved in government funding doesn't sound fertile for creative development for anyone.
Yeah, the people who... going to get myself in trouble, but anyway, the people who were traditionally, you know, good producers in Australia are the people who are really good at the government paperwork. They know how to fill in that application and get that grant or get that development funding or whatever it is, or they're in that particular circle, as opposed to people who are, you know, the studio system's a lot different, you know. So something like, you know, this feature that I've got, that I've just done, Blue World Order, available on iTunes now, you know, it's not really a Screen Australia kind of film. So done completely outside the system, but still able to use, we've got really good tax breaks down there and stuff, so we get a lot of bang for the buck on screen, but it's not something that, you know, Screen Australia invested in, you know. So it all had to be done privately, and that's really inventing the wheel, because you're, you know, in America and particularly in LA, people understand the business, they know what movies are, they know how to get a return, there's a whole infrastructure around it. Back home, you know, I'm talking to property developers or dentists or, you know, just mom and pa investors, so you really have to lay the business plan out very well and, you know, create that business plan, because I don't think any two projects get done the same way. It's probably true everywhere, but yeah, in Australia it was very much cutting the path with the machete to create the infrastructure before you can actually just, you know, rinse and repeat. And Blue World was very much a proof of the business model, so that we could do it once and then hopefully rinse and repeat. And luckily that's worked out, so I'm hoping that the next time around it will be a lot easier.
Well, you know what, I was interested in something you said. You said how you sort of specialize in the post-production side of things and editing and VFX. And I think that definitely shows in your film that you one of the more impressive things, I think, about Blue World Order is, you know, for lack of a better way to express it, Hollywood-level visuals from the independent sphere, which is kind of unheard of.
Look, it's, yeah, I think what that education taught me was how to identify talent. And so the people that I had, you know, I had an amazing bunch of talented freelancers working on it, just doing bits and pieces because, you know, I could, and so of course I didn't do it all myself, but I think I understood enough of what they were doing to recognize when someone knew what they were talking about or didn't. So, you know, there's sort of an old saying is just because you can do it all yourself doesn't mean you should. And so the biggest decision for me was very much going, you know, what do I physically do myself and what do I hand off? And, you know, that was a process, and that brings its own challenges because you get inconsistencies of quality from different people and you get, you know, but you still got to pay everyone, so you can't go back and get, could you redo that stuff that they did? But I was usually able to do enough of it myself or work out who would be a good fit for each skill. Sorry. Keep going.
Sorry.
Down there. Yeah, so...
I mean, did Blue World Order sort of represent a rare opportunity for people to be involved in something in a genre that the film board doesn't normally support?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think one of the reasons Blue World worked was it gave a whole bunch of people the opportunity to step up, work on a feature. So, you know, recent graduates and things, or people who had were very skilled but had been working in corporates or something, it was an opportunity to work on a feature film and give them something that they wanted. So, you know, I had to sort of do deals with everyone individually to sort of say, what do you want out of this? And, you know, for my director of photography, he was able to shoot a feature film in his hometown and go home to his wife and kids every night. And, you know, rather than having to be away for 3 months at a time. And so that was very appealing for him. So I obviously got him for, you know, a much better deal than I probably would have otherwise. And it was finding each of those people. It was finding graduates who were very skilled, but they didn't have features on their reel, so they might not have been able to get into the big effects houses. So they could do two or three shots on a reel film. That was enough to, you know, get them the foot in the door to the next thing. So Blue World was very much designed as a vehicle to help everyone step up a little bit. And it really went from, you know, the original inception, you know, the idea of it was a super low-budget, handheld 5D shot, run-and-gun thing, to, as we went, it grew and grew and grew. And
right, so you didn't start with this grand plan to make what looks like a multi-million dollar film.
No.
You started with a guerrilla filmmaking attitude.
Yeah, very much. It was very much a guerrilla filmmaking thing. And then as you go through it, you kind of look and you go, well, you know what, if we do this, if we do that, it gives those opportunities. And you know, there's a bit of a domino effect, because then you try and cast up in some places. And, you know, once you get Billy Zane or Jack Thompson to say yes, then all suddenly, well, you've got to have a trailer on set, or you've got to have, you know, you've got to have other things that that snowball. And so keeping that sensible and knowing where that price point was. In Australia, there's a thing called the producer offset, which is a tax break that is for feature films, but there's got to be a certain minimum spend. And so you could either spend below that and all that money you kind of kiss goodbye, or you hope to make back through sales, or you go a bit bigger and you go over that budget threshold and suddenly you're eligible for this tax offset, which then makes it a lot more attractive to investors. It makes, you know, more attractive to cast, because they're probably going, oh, well, it's probably not going to suck so bad if it's got a certain amount of budget or whatnot. But Blue World very much went from the guerrilla thing, and then as we went along and re-looked at things, and right up to the point of, you know, we decided to shoot on a particular camera, you know. So rather than handheld 5Ds, we're like, well, you know what, if it looks good and it sounds good, that's 90% of your battle. So we'll shoot it on, you know, these cameras that will look like film, and, you know, make sure we've got good sound people there. And yeah, it's finding that balance. The challenge has been that rather than going from this kind of really cool guerrilla indie film, we got to a stage where, you know, some people go, oh, well, it's, you know, it's like a B-grade Hollywood film, and which puts you in a different category, you know. So it's almost like a, I don't want to say bad Hollywood film, but, you know, it looks like a...
Well, it's better than most Hollywood films.
Well,
but I see what you're I see what you're saying. You're saying that instead of being judged as a scrappy film,
yeah,
that made it work from you know, on a shoestring,
yeah,
some people who are ignorant, I'll call them ignorant,
because yeah, sure.
I mean, as a film festival programmer, you know, I see a lot of movies, and and you know, yours right from the get go, first scene, you're like, this is a real fucking movie.
Oh, great.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And then, I don't know if I got to tell you this before, but the opening credit sequence.
Oh, great. Thanks.
You know, wonderfully put together. You know, and there's very few features get sent to working the festival circuit,
yeah,
that have a credit sequence, you know, that good and thematic. You know, you did a lot to set yourself above. But I see what you're saying. You set yourself so far above the guerrilla filmmakers that some people assume you're not one.
Well, I think that's the quandary. We were too successful for our own good in a lot of ways. I mean, I guess I'd rather be in that situation, but, you know, it really was made in a from nothing with no support anywhere other than what we forged in the blood, sweat, and tears of, you know, the people who helped, and was very much a guerrilla film. We wanted it to look like a real film, but then people go, oh, it's a studio film, but, you know, oh, it's, you know, a B-grade studio film. And, it does. It gets judged in a different way sometimes. And you want to say, but you don't understand. and look, that's a good thing as a filmmaker, because I think it's good advice for every filmmaker out there, is because your audience doesn't care. They do not care how you made it, whatever. They care about what's in the frame, whether you sat for 40 hours in freezing snow and to get that shot and it cost you $40,000. They don't care. You know, like, no. They only care about what they see, and how you got there is irrelevant to them. And that's good to keep in mind, because if you can find a way to get it on the screen, then that's great. You know, they don't care whether you used an expensive Technocrane to get that shot or whether you did it on the end of a stick and swung it in, because they only care about the result. So, you know, that's something that I think a lot of filmmakers need to remember and keep reminding themselves of, because you do get judged really harshly as soon as you put anything into the world, obviously. And it's, you know, some people love it and some people go, oh, what a load of crap. And you're going to get that. You know, you get people saying that the Star Wars movies are a load of crap. And you're like, you may not have liked the story or what it told, but it's the absolute pinnacle of, you know, filmmaking at the moment with that technology, and the way it looks and sounds and everything is amazing. Doesn't mean everyone's going to like it. So,
It is a very interesting time for film, because at this point, technical brilliance is so accessible.
Yeah. Yep.
It's more accessible than it's ever been. It used to be, you know, Ridley Scott could walk around saying, no one can make a film look like I can.
Yeah.
And now there's kids in college who can make a film. They can. Well, they probably can't compare to his lighting and whatnot, but they can come close.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's true. I look at our effects, and some people go, oh, a couple of effects are a bit hokey. And you go, yeah, by today's standards, sure. But I looked at Return of the Jedi the other day, you know, and you go, well, compare, if you release both of those films side by side, then, you know, it's sort of for its time. And like you say, it's expectations. These days, people expect everything to look real. And if it's not amazing, then it's substandard rather than...
That's true. Especially, I mean, your genre of sci-fi, hard sci-fi, really. I think it deserves a hard sci-fi label.
Oh, jeez.
You know, it's genuine science fiction. Which I think, well, the sci-fi nerds can argue for hours about what is and isn't, you know, what's soft and hard sci-fi. But yeah, in the hard sci-fi world now, it really is, standards are high.
Yeah. And, you know, it's fantastic. But, you know, I still believe that you have to, it all comes down to character and story. Like, you need to care about, if you don't care about what's the people in there and what's happening to them, the rest of it doesn't matter. You know, you can have the most amazing effects in the world, but if you just don't care about what's going on or the people there, then it's all irrelevant.
So, I know I'm casting some shade, but the Star Wars prequels prove that technical brilliance with bad story and bad characters equals no one is. Yeah. It's a disaster.
I mean, you know, the other thing is you look at those now, the prequels, and even though they were cutting edge for their time, they're virtually unwatchable by today's standards because things look like a bad computer game, you know?
Although A New Hope, the first Star Wars film.
Yep.
I even have a theatrical version of it ripped off of...
Yep.
Off of Laserdisc. Remember the old 12-inch Laserdisc? And And you can watch that a million times, even though as the TIE fighters move around, there's a little shaded box around them.
Yeah,
and, you know, I know that's stuff that Lucas was desperate to repair later on. But it doesn't matter that it's not cutting edge because it's still a great story.
Yeah, you completely forgive that stuff. And, you know, people would argue, you know, the remastered Star Wars ones people liked less because it didn't... you know, they were amazing thing effects at the time that they put in, but they still, you know, CG, we got to this pinnacle of practical effects where we got things looking amazing practically and everything looks real. And then CG has sort of come along where it's only now just getting to the point where things look real. And obviously you had to take a few steps back before we could go forward again. But, you know, some of those films, like the Star Wars prequels, really suffered with that, where it clearly looks, you know, CG.
Yeah. Even, just basic spaceships looked too clean and too undetailed.
Yeah, I'm probably suddenly not going to get a job with George Lucas.
Well, I can leave that part out if you want. Yeah, sure, no, we can, you know.
It's all good. Well, you know, from the original Star Wars being, you know, I think it's one of the best films of all time from a...
Yeah, and completely seminal. I mean, it is the film that launched 1,000 ships.
Yeah, absolutely. It was the one film, you know, it hit me at the right time. It was the one film we were allowed to stay up late for and watch, you know. It's sort of one of the very first films I ever remember watching.
So what's your next focus?
So look, you know, Blue World, it's just come out in the States and Canada, but that's it so far. Like the other, it's sold into about another 20 territories so far, and they haven't released yet. So, you know, it's still, we've got to help manage and promote and get those releases happening. And I've got a couple of projects that are sort of on the boil. One of them that looks quite promising is there's a friend of mine who's an author. His name is Matthew Riley. He's a big sort of international best-selling author. And he has a whole bunch of franchises of really big action blockbuster novels that he's turning into films. He's living in LA now. But his first novel is a book called Contest that I've sort of just gotten the rights to, which is a... it's sort of eight alien species trapped in a New York State library, battle to the death, you know. It's very genuine, hardcore sci-fi, but a really cool story. Very simple and sellable and interesting. And I'm in the middle of talking with Weta Workshop at the moment about sort of co-producing that. So it's one of those things that will be a genuine, scary as hell kind of, you know, thriller that will be a good international beast if we can pull that off. So that's something that we're doing now. And, you know, Matthew's got a really good following, but he hasn't had a film made yet. So I think it will be something that will hopefully tip the dominoes for him and get some of his other stuff made. His other films are massive, so... they're a lot harder to get greenlit, but this one we can do pretty achievably, I think.
Are the actual series where is each of his novels separate, or is it actually?
He's got two sort of main franchises.
I'm just imagining you getting your sinking your teeth into a franchise.
That'd be fantastic. Well, I'm over here now to basically say, look, this is what we can do for nothing. Give me a shot.
Right.
So I'm trying to meet with agents, directors, anyone I can talk to and get the film in front of. And in two things, you know, obviously the writing, directing, or directing other stuff, and then my own projects. And then the other string to our bow is that we can produce something back home, which is really good bang for your buck. We've got... a lot less restrictions, I think, than a lot of places. Good tax incentives and really competent crew. So obviously we need to, you know, the US is where you get your distribution deals done and meet the people who can actually get it out to the world. But as far as creating the content, you know, we can do that, I think, as good as anywhere at a much cheaper price point than a lot of places. So that's one of the things that I'm sort of talking about.
I mean, it almost sounds like you're setting up a mini studio in Australia.
Yeah.
I mean, similar to what Peter Jackson did with Weta in a way.
Well, look.
Right? Because they basically created the infrastructure there.
Quite literally, immediately before I did Blue World, I was working on The Hobbit for the Hobbit movies for a few years. And I was fortunate enough to kind of be able to see what Peter had done in Wellington and chat to him about how he'd done that and how he'd built this ecosystem. And, you know, Wellington is a fantastic, beautiful place, but it is really challenging to shoot films there. It's windy and rainy and logistically quite hard to get around. And he's been able to do this stuff there. And I went, well, you know, where I live, it's like LA. There's no rain, hardly ever any rain. And, but there's no traffic and easy logistics. And it's really ripe for exactly that. So, you know, I wanted to try and build something there that we could just really churn out some good stuff and gradually grow the size of it. You know, each project brings more infrastructure and all the rest of it. And Blue World was a really good, you know, test case for that. And then we've got some more things going on. We just need to convince the right people.
I imagine so, yeah. I mean, I imagine the Blue World trailer is a great way to show someone with a short attention span just what you can do.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, hope so. Well, yeah, we've got a little 30-second trailer and then a 2-minute thing. And, you know, we were talking with one of your other filmmakers earlier about, you know, shorts being a calling card and then doing a film. We kind of did a feature as a calling card, but, you know, it's very hard to watch a feature, so...
It is a funny world we're in because there's the argument on all sides, right? There's people who say shorts are a good calling card, but then shorts can't ever go anywhere.
Yeah.
And then I've talked to many filmmakers who was like, you know what? I looked at it and I decided I'd try to make a feature for the short budget, same budget as the short, just to have a feature to show. Mm. It's there's no right answer. That's the one thing I know for sure is there's no golden path.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. For anything, there is no one way to make a film. Like, you do it however you can get it done. There's good and bad advice, of course, but... well, Blue World started with a short. A friend of mine, Dallas Bland, and I made a short in 2012 for a local film festival, and... you know, that worked out well. And then people were sort of saying, oh, what's next? What else happens in this world? And so we, you know, we developed a TV series out of it. And then quite literally just to be able to make it went, well, you know, let's make the first sort of couple of episodes, if you like, as a feature because it's 40% tax break for features and, you know, 20 for TV. So it was a much more tangible thing. And that's a, you know, if it costs you 30 grand to make a short, you kind of, you're losing 30 grand or you're not losing it, but it's very hard to make back. Whereas with a feature, you've actually got a real chance to recoup that. And so it just made sense to do that first.
So Blue World is actually a few TV, and in theory it's episodes put together. I mean, obviously it's not... But the genesis of it was a few episodes?
Yeah, so it was probably the first.
I could see that. Now that you say that, I could definitely see how if someone told you, all right, we want you to break it up into TV episodes now, it's like the first part of a season.
Yeah, well, it's probably the first.
There's enough to that world. There's enough to tell.
The other thing is, you know, I write novels and then once we started doing that, I went away and wrote the Blue World Order novel, which fits into the universe that I got with the other novels. So there's actually a massive wealth of story and world building behind it. And in the film, you get a snippet of it. But there's a huge amount of story, and particularly, you know, the technology that is all there. It's, even though it's not real technology, it's all based in real science so that it's plausible in some way, you know, in the world you build. And so that works in now with, you know, The Rule of Knowledge, which is a novel, and then the rest of the sort of series that we built with Blue World. So, you know, I would love to be able to, you know, do a Netflix series or something with Blue World, the series, because it's, you know, it's set up for that perfectly. You know, we had to do it as a feature to start with, and make it work as a feature. You know, it was rewritten. It wasn't just the...
Yeah, no, it was clearly, it's clearly is a feature.
But yeah,
it's got a beginning, a middle, and end in everything.
Yeah, wow. It's a real movie, yeah.
I see a lot of features that are not real movies. So that really, as sarcastic as you were, it's true. It's a real movie.
Oh, geez, I appreciate that. No, thank you. It's look, I'm incredibly proud of it, to be honest, given knowing where it came from. I know the audience doesn't care, but, you know, I care. I care that the people who worked on it, I wish I could give back to them more. You know, I'm sort of doing whatever I can to give it its best life and most exposure so that they actually feel some kind of pride that all that hard work they put in, you know, has a tangible result. And it's, you know, it's tough to get out there because you're competing against Star Wars. You know, you're competing against, particularly in Australia where, you know, the amount of films released in the cinemas each week, you know, it's a very small curated percentage of what gets released here. So, you know, if you're trying to convince them to put a low-budget indie sci-fi on, but they've got, you know, Fast and the Furious 8 and then the next two Saw movies or whatever it is, that they know that they're going to sell those sessions out, it's a hard sell, particularly when the ticket prices are the same for both, you know. So if you've got your $20 and you go, oh, I can watch the next Star Wars or I can go watch Blue World Order, it's a hard sell. So
yeah, and you made a very interesting and smart choice, which is to have all your actors use an American accent. Yeah. But that, I guess that means that you can't be the home team. You can't be the little Australian film that can,
yeah,
because the Aussies can't come out and, you know, they hear the American accent. So I assume, like, you can't be the hometown favorite.
It's that, yeah, way. It's interesting. A lot of Australian films that do well, they play on the Australian culture, and that's cool, and there's very much a place for those. For something like Blue World, it needed to be a film made for a global market. You know, you could nearly have an American remake of it if we did it in Australian accents, but...
Yeah, I mean, well, there's... Just logically,
yeah,
you can't do hard sci-fi with an accent because you can't just... So how come in the future, like, everyone has an Australian
that's
accent?
That's right.
Like is there really... It would have been highly illogical.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking in my head, it's too bad that you don't get a theatrical release in Australia.
Mm. Well...
Because you kind of deserve it.
We've done some small theatrical release. It's not nothing, but it's just... It's a hard sell for a wide theatrical release.
Yeah. But obviously I'm just blowing smoke, I guess. Yeah. But if enough people knew, you know, that it's a homegrown, you know, from the bottom up Australian effort, they probably would want to check it out and support it.
There's a lot of,
you know, which is not the case. You know, if somebody in L.A. made a good little feature, I've seen a lot of them, You can't say, hey, come see this great little feature that
made in L.A. Yeah.
That, you know, some outsiders who can't get hired by the studios did.
Yeah.
You know, you'd think people would be like, yeah, I want to help support those filmmakers, but it's not going to happen.
It's, you know, you're very much, you're either in the machine or you're not. Mm. And the machine keeps changing, but when you really are outside the machine, you know, they've got their deals, they've got their, you know, the studios say, well, you're getting... distributors say you're taking these four films, and even if an exhibitor says, oh, I kind of want to put this one on, they might go, well, if you don't take these four, you don't get Star Wars or something, you know. So
yeah.
So there's a whole bunch of politics outside of it and business deals that are a lot bigger and harder to crack than just whether someone wants to put it on. And it's all economics, and I get all that, but you've got to try. I sometimes say, you know, you've got to chuck a Bradbury. There's a Winter Olympic speed skater, guy called Stephen Bradbury, who's an Australian. And he was in the final of the Olympics, and he wasn't a favourite or anything like that. And I think this was the it was maybe two Olympics ago, Winter Olympics. And he had... He was skating along, he was last, and they had a crash in front of him, and every other skater fell over. He skated past them and won a gold medal. And, you know, and so that's sort of this analogy that I use, that that guy was still good. He was, you know, he's an amazing athlete. He made it to the final of the Winter Olympics, so he's still there. But he won a gold medal because he was in the race. He got himself in the race, and it's like... Even if your chances are slim, and even you've got to be in the race, otherwise you're never going to win. You know, you're never going to. You've got to get yourself a seat at the table, and you've got to put yourself in a position where you can get lucky. A lot of people say, "Oh, it's all luck, and it's who you know, and everything like that." And I'm like, absolutely, but luck isn't an accident. You know, if you make the effort to go to those networking events and meet those people, and invest your time in that stuff, the chances of you getting lucky and meeting someone who you connect with and you help each other, that's much higher than if you're sitting at home, you know, criticizing everyone and not doing it. So, yeah, you've got to...
It's a well-known trope, or it's you hear it a lot, that when people try to criticize someone for their luck and and the person always says, you know, it's, I had to put myself in that position to be lucky.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like the Bradbury reference. Yeah. I thought you were talking about Ray Bradbury.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. It's Stephen Bradbury. I'm bringing him back for the Winter Olympics. There you go. Yeah, but look it up. There's Stephen Bradbury gold medal.
And make a good film. Heck, I, Tonya was a good film.
Yeah, yeah.
Make a Bradbury film.
Yeah, there we go. Actually, I've got an Olympic film that I want to make. The story, this was the first film I was going to make, but it was you know, much bigger budget than what I could start with, which is the story of a girl called Lauren Burns, who won the gold medal in the 2000 Sydney Olympics for Taekwondo. So that's kind of Rocky for chicks. You know, it's mm-hmm. a real... there's never been a really good sport Taekwondo movie done. There's been lots of martial arts films, but particularly the way the sport was at that time, and it was, you know, its first year in the Olympics and all this sort of stuff, and, you know, female-driven story and just a really interesting road to get there. So that's another project that I'd love to make happen if possible. But, you know, it takes a little bit more of a budget than what I had the first time round. So, yeah, we'll see.
It's good to hear you have so many irons in the fire, or at least things on your mind.
Got plenty of ideas, yeah.
As usual, Che proved that the filmmakers are just really nice people. I have to tell you, I had the best time with Che. It was great to have him here. His film, Blue World Order, is available on iTunes right now, so I highly recommend you go watch it. As always, you can get a link to it at discoverfilm.net, and you can see all the other great films of the filmmakers I've interviewed at discoverfilm.net. At discoverfilm.net, you can also learn about the Sherman Oaks Film Festival and Film Invasion LA. And you can even learn a little bit about me. All right, I think we're done. Thanks for listening.